We're talking about it. This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson on 900 CHML.
Hey, it's Hamilton Today. I'm Curtis Thompson, Scott's son. Major Tom McKay is on the board. Wild Will Erskine booking the guests. And the legendary CHML newsroom, Dave Woodard and Jennifer McQueen. Here's Scott Thompson.
It is Hamilton Today. I'm Scott Thompson, 900 CHML. Interesting that inflation rate down a slight tick to 2.8%. Always good news. Also good news locally, big priority for Hamilton Health Sciences recruiting. So there you go. What else we got? Roy McMurtry, remember him? Former Ontario General, has passed away at the age of 91. And the Falcons have checked back into the Sheraton Hotel for another season, a little earlier this year, but we'll talk about that coming up a little later on. You've heard a lot about former Prime Minister Brian Mulroney, his body now lying in state in Ottawa, and then in Montreal, funeral on Saturday and on Friday between 5 and 6 in the afternoon, starting at 5 o'clock, so the last hour of this show, a Brian Mulroney special, and it's hosted by Ben Mulroney. A family remembers and has all kinds of great interviews and what have you. The full deal will play on the weekend, on Saturday, but we'll play an hour of that coming up on Friday afternoon at 5 o'clock. And we're going to play you a couple of clips because it's been fascinating listening to reaction from either side of the political spectrum on this and on the passing of the former prime minister. And although many, I guess at the end of the day, it's your legacy and what people remember 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30 years after you have held your term as to whether you're a success or not. And I mean, he's being credited with an awful lot, including his relationship with the United States, his stance on climate change, and it's just been fascinating. And you're hoping, as you sit and watch all of this, that the politicians of today might sit back and look at the Brian Mulroney's of the day in that era and learn something from it. But here's what former President Bush had to say about Brian Mulroney, and you will hear this on the special coming up this Friday at 5 o'clock.
One of the most amazing things about him was his understanding of American politics. He obviously paid close attention to it. He knew a lot about it and would call and offer insights, not on a regular basis. He knew how busy the president can be, but on occasion. And plus, I would see him visiting when he would visit my mother and dad, and we would sit around and talk American politics or politics in general. He was a great friend of the United States, but first and foremost, he was a his number one priority was the people of Canada.
And former President Bush on the social aspect of this relationship between Canada and the United States, especially when it came to the prime minister and singing.
I remember when he popped up at the table when we were visiting up in Canada and started singing. I said, oh, my God, what is this guy up to? And all of a sudden, his he not only could he carry a tune, but he's a really good singer. And it was clear that he loved to sing and he loved to project through song. Frankly, I was amazed. I remember Laura and I went up to visit the Demarais place in remote Canada. We had a lovely dinner. It might have been after a few wines that he got up and sang some beautiful Irish hymns, and he had a great voice. I come from a family with no voices that can sing, but this man could sing.
Again, some excerpts from the special you'll hear Friday afternoon between 5 and 6. A family remembers, remembering Brian Mulroney, hosted by Ben Mulroney. Here's what Wayne Gretzky had to say when he got a call before a big game.
We were getting ready, game 3 in the afternoon, and in those days it was house phones, basically. And the phone rang, it was your dad's chief of staff, and he said, Mr. Gretzky, the prime minister would like to talk to you and wish you good luck. And I said, well, absolutely. I said, I'm just getting dressed. Can you call back in like 10 minutes? So I had it all set up and he called back in 10 minutes. And I said, Dad, you better get the phone. And he's standing there and I could just see his jaw dropping more and more and his eyes getting bigger and bigger. And he's looking at me. He goes, can you believe the prime minister of Canada is calling me? And I looked at him. I said, I think he's calling for me. I'm playing the game tonight.
Some memories of Brian Mulroney and various Canadians he touched, including Wayne Gretzky there. You can hear the whole thing on Friday and Saturday. Starting Friday at 5 o'clock between 5 and 6, a Brian Mulroney special hosted by Ben and a family remembers coming up right here on CHML Friday at 5. So last day of fall, spring officially arrives, I believe, 11:06 tonight, and it's kind of snowing out. So how apropos that spring is starting as the Falcons have checked into the Sheridan on this surprisingly last day of winter. Here is an update on the first sighting of the Falcons back at the Sheridan. Krista Jackson with us, Falcon Watch coordinator, and here now. Krista, thank you for the time. I hope you're doing well.
I am. Thank you for having us, Scott. It's great to be back. We are very excited. On March 17th, St. Patrick's Day, we got our first glimpse of the egg for the year. And they, in recent history, they have been having the scrape in the east side of the ledge. So it's right close to the camera. This year, they have changed it. So it's now on the west edge of the ledge, which gives us a much better view with the camera. So it's going to make things easier for us. However, we've had a really good mama here, a McKeever, sitting on her egg. So we've had sight of one, but we can't confirm yet whether there are more than one. So far, she's had two clutches here in Hamilton, and both have had four. So we do expect to have more, but we haven't had any shots of the camera revealing more eggs yet.
So at this point, one egg.
At this point, one egg that we know of, yes. It usually, they do start laying them. It usually does take a few days to lay, so it's not atypical at all. Mm-hmm. It is a little bit earlier than usual, but only by one day. For our oldest record, or earliest one, would have been for March 18th, and that was back in 2020. So we have beat it by one day.
So how do you explain the change location from one side of the ledge to the other?
You know what? That we can't really explain. It is always up to them. For years, Madam X actually did have the scrape. She used that edge of the nest, and it wasn't until her last time laying eggs, I believe, she actually switched it to the west side. And then when Lily and Ozzy were in residence at the Sheraton, they also used the west edge. So we're very happy. Sorry, they used the east edge. We're very happy they've gone back to the west because it gives us a better view. That way we can keep track once they start hatching and how many eggs are laid. It just makes things a bit easier to monitor the situation.
Talk about this area, if you haven't seen a picture of this or watched any of the video or such, and the actual nesting site. Is there a nest per se?
So what the nest is at the top of the 18th floor, there's three sets of bay windows, and yeah, the one that is closest to the east side is where the Falcons have been residing. And it's just like a little, like it's just the roof to the bay windows, in which there's a ledge that kind of protects it from anything falling out. And it's just gravel that's there, and they just literally will move the gravel around to create what we call a scrape. There's also where the brick for the building is. There's a little ledge where they can go underneath, which gives them a little bit of protection from if like extremely rainy days and such. But obviously, when they have the eggs, the whichever adult will be incubating will be on the egg, so they won't get the protection. But we have seen in the past years where chicks will go under there on more rainy days and such to try and stay dry, I guess.
So how come no nest per se, that they just use the gravel that's in that area, you know, on that ledge?
That's just what the Falcons do. Like in the wild, they'll do it in cliff edges and stuff. They don't actually right. build nests. They just kind of hollow out a little area. I'm not really sure what the science is behind it, but that's just how they do things. And the gravel kind of, because it's stone, it does mimic the natural environment a little bit. The 18th floor, obviously, it's higher up, so it's kind of like a man-made cliff for them. Mm-hmm. So it's a bit more like a natural environment that they've accustomed to while being around man.
And this mother is a past baby, correct?
No. Actually, McKeever was from the Windsor, the Ambassador Bridge in Windsor.
Okay.
It is Judson, which is the father. He is basically the great-grandson of Madame X. So he's the descendant.
Wow, that's amazing. So you're hoping for four eggs. Is that the max?
I have heard of clutches having five eggs. I don't believe we've ever had more than four in the history of all the eggs in Hamilton. It's always been four or under. To me, it doesn't matter how many, as long as they're all healthy, hatch good, and of course, fledged safely in our city.
So when do you hope to see, or when will she finish laying eggs? A couple of days? Is that accurate?
It usually spans over a few days, and then it'll be close to Mother's Day when they start hatching.
And how many babies has this ledge hosted over the years?
I believe the number is around 68.
Wow.
Most of them are the ones that were eggs laid there. There were two different years. We had two eggs each time that were snuck into the nest. They're from other falcon nests that had to be relocated. Mm-hmm. So they actually did kind of adopt two as well at two different years.
Wow, that's amazing. So just like the Sheridan, you talked about the Ambassador Bridge. Are there certain areas that they all keep going to and it's just one big happy family?
There seems to be certain areas. Just I don't know if there's like a little animal, you know how on it, but they seem to have certain areas that it's a great nest site. So once it's discovered, there's always going to be, and that's what it has been for the Sheridan. Obviously, it was discovered in the early 90s that it was a great place to have chicks and raise your little family. It's never been vacated. We've always had falcons there ever since. And we've also had turf wars and stuff. So It just seems to be something about the environment. Lots of food high up imitates nature well enough. So it's a pretty good area for a peregrine falcon to raise their family, right?
And how do we watch?
So you can go on, if you Google Hamilton Falcon Watch, there is the website will come up. We do have the videos. We do actually have a new video as well that was generously donated. All the details on that are from the website. But if you just Google Hamilton Falcon Watch, it will come up and all the details there. You can always reach out on Facebook as well as Instagram as well.
All right, Krista Jackson with us, Falcon Watch Coordinator. The Falcon family has returned to the Sheridan again for another season and another stay. Krista, good luck. It's fascinating to hear the stories. Be well.
Thank you. You as well. Take care.
7 months after the separation from the Prime Minister, Sophie Trudeau is speaking up about her separation from Justin Trudeau. That's the headline. To talk more about all of this, and we'll try to squeeze in some royals too, Alyssa Freeman with us, PR and pop culture expert. She's here now. Alyssa, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Yes, I am. Thanks for having me on, Scott.
So, Alyssa, I remember when the Prime Minister and his wife separated, the media sort of told, you know, give them space, give them privacy, and everybody did. I mean, everybody just kind of left it all alone. And then, like, that first couple of days, the first week, there was social media of the Prime Minister with his kids at the movies, I think a couple of times, and everybody in the media is wondering, like, well, I thought you wanted to stay out of the public eye, and here you are on social media. Why are we getting this now, do you think?
Isn't this interesting? You know, for the amount of time that Sophie Gregoire Trudeau was First Lady, how often did we really hear from her?
Yeah.
And I had to think about that. And I know what your answer would be, and I'd probably agree with you right now. It was like not a heck of a lot. You know, when he was first elected to office, they were a very beautiful power couple, and they seemed to complement one another. And then, you know, as what most first ladies do, they take their causes and they have full calendars and they go here and they go there. But really, you know, did she ever make sort of a very definitive mark as being a first lady while her husband was in power? I'm going to say no. Now, this is not to discount how difficult it is to be married to a head of state and all the issues that come with that, plus raising children. You have staff, though. Let's remember that. And there's a reason to be quiet about things. However, you come out now with a book. and you are very chuffed about being featured in Vogue and with the Vogue article and putting yourself out there about what you want to talk about and how, you know, you deserve more than just to have your needs and wants met as a passing fancy, that you should be more of the center of attention and not just as an afterthought. So here we have Sophie positioning herself very much as her own woman, very much as embracing the spotlight and being in her own view, the center of attention. However, the public, and especially the jaded Canadian public, Scott, is simply not buying it.
Does she have basically a year to get this out before he perhaps leaves as prime minister? After that, will anyone care? So is this the sweet spot for the release of this?
Probably. I mean, whenever you release a book, you always try to figure, you know, when is good timing? And I don't think that Sophie is as vindictive to do this right before an election campaign. I don't think that would do her any good. I mean, it would be really seems being vindictive, and it certainly wouldn't do him any good. So as a result, whenever you try and time these releases, you try and do it when you hit a sweet spot and when you feel that you can garner as much media for yourself as possible. But, you know, Scott, when I go through the comments on posts, for example, the Instagram post that Vogue magazine puts out, when she there, you know, obviously the article is talking about her separation. One person says, I would also like to separate from Justin Trudeau. Who can I talk to about that? So, you know, she is living a comfortable life funded by taxpayers and is in no position to speak on the challenges faced by real independent single mothers. So, you know, you're always going to have naysayers, Scott, always. There's 20% of your public that is not ever, ever, ever going to like you. But what I'm finding here is that Canadians specifically are venting and using her as a proxy to vent about their frustrations about the current government.
That being said, does she relate to the does the average Canadian man or woman relate to her, or does she suffer from the same sort of situation that the prime minister does, that people think they're elite and out of touch?
I think what she's trying to do is make herself relatable, to make herself seen as every woman. I think in many cases that, yes, yeah, Sophie Coguard-Trudeau can be relatable, given, you know, many women and many people share the same circumstances of, you know, busy lives, children growing up, you know, not trying to lose yourself in the mix. So I think that a lot of people can relate to that and will enjoy reading what she has to say. So, like I say, there's going to be a part of the public that is really going to embrace this, and there's going to be a part of the public that is not. But as you say, you know, getting into your zone, being in the sweet spot of gathering attention, when you come out with a book, Scott, you have a very, very short runway in order to get out your message and to get as much publicity as possible. So you want the light to shine very hot, hot, hot. In this case, she knows she's going to have Trudeau haters coming after her, but that's something that they, you know, specifically expect. And I am sure if somebody asks her about it, she's already been media trained and has all her answers at the ready.
Do you think there'll be any revelation here? At the end of the day, I'm guessing that the public feels the same way about her as they do about him, unless she's going to deal some sort of dirt or back room information. Like, other than being spiritual and enjoying the day, are we going to get anything out of this?
No.
Are we going to learn anything?
No, I don't think so. And I think that Sophie Coguard-Trudeau is way as much smarter than that, because, you know, for the one salacious detail that she may reveal, you know, that lives with you. And it also lives with her children. And I think that she is more concerned about the reputation and her privacy of her kids than she certainly is about the reputation and the privacy of her husband. So will she get into any salacious details? Because, you know, once you squeeze the toothpaste out of the tube, there's no putting it back in. So I think that she's going to be very, very mindful of what she's revealing, save for what she has already said, in that it was just time for her to take control of her own life.
All right. We're hearing many tributes to former Prime Minister Brian Mulroney, who's lying in state in Ottawa now. And does this make people look at the politics of yesteryear and today, or and compare the two? Because we're certainly hearing a lot of positive things from both sides of the aisle, all sides of the aisle. But I guess that's common in a situation like this.
It absolutely is. But I have to tell you that personally, I've been wistful. And I remember, I think that Mulroney was the first prime minister that I voted for, to be quite honest. And it sort of harkens back to a time when, and this is when we start sounding really old, Scott, but, you know, when things were simpler, when things seemed, you know, better, and there wasn't so much strife, and we, you know, there was less to worry about, and social media really wasn't a thing. So, yeah, you know, I think that that's just a natural sentiment when, you know, any head of state dies. And was he a perfect man? No. But was he overall great for the country and did very important things, including NAFTA? Then I think that that's what people will remember.
Leadership learned from him on a day like today or a week like this week?
You know, that type of leadership, I want to say that that's gone with history, and I hate to think that, but I think that he exemplified a real statesmanhood, the way he got along with other heads of states, the way that he found commonalities. You know, I think, I don't know if you remember when he was on stage with Reagan and they both sang "When Irish Eyes Are Smiling." You know, we all looked at that and we smiled, but then we also realized that that made for probably a lot easier when, you know, there were challenges to overcome and crunchy conversations that had to happen. So do I think that our heads of state necessarily do that in the same way? No, I do not.
Alyssa Freeman with us, PR and pop culture expert, talking everything politics. We'll get to royals next time. Alyssa, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
Oh, thanks for having me on, Scott.
Lots of interest in EVs over the last couple of years, and lots of interest in Ontario, and as they change over their auto industry to a more renewable line. It works in some situations, but not in every situation. We're not sure what happened here and what went wrong with Hertz. The rental car company announced it was selling roughly a third of its EVs of its fleet and replacing the CEO, who they've replaced more than tires, we'll say, in the last couple of years. What is the issue with Hertz and EVs? Let's bring in Marvin Ryder, professor DeGroote School of Business, McMaster University, here now. Marvin, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I am. Always remember to rotate your CEOs every 100,000.
That's what it sounds like is happening here. Is this about a bad biz template or an EV? What's the story here, Marvin?
Well, I think it's less about an EV than a company that's been struggling and struggling for some time. This is the fifth CEO in 4 years that are coming in. On paper, every one of these CEOs look good, but they just can't seem to shoot straight. But let me narrow in for a second on the question of EVs. So Hertz, about 2 years ago, said that we're going to embrace EV technology, and they actually announced plans to buy 175,000 EVs. Some of them Teslas, some from other people, but that never actually fully happened. All they ever wound up doing was buying 60,000 EVs from Tesla. Everything seemed to be going along pretty well until, let's say about 6 months ago, when Tesla, facing more competition from all the new EVs entering the marketplace, announced that to be competitive, they were going to cut the price of their new models. Now, why does that cause Hertz a problem? Well, if you're a car company, a rental car company, you buy cars, rent them out for a while, but then you ultimately sell them as used cars. If I cut the price of new cars dramatically, guess what? The price of used cars get hit dramatically. And so Hertz was forced to write down the value of its EV fleet. And it made the decision that it would sell one-third, 20,000 of the 60,000 cars. And they took nearly a quarter of a billion dollar hit. $250 million hit because of all of this. Now, the other little problem with EVs and rental cars is if I have a gas-powered car, and I don't know how many of your listeners have rented a car, but you have a couple of choices. One is you can prepay for a tank of gas, bring it back wherever it is on the gauge. Don't worry, you prepaid for the gas. Or you are required to bring the gas tank back full. And that's what I do. I choose that because I never use a whole lot of gas. I'll just stop on my way to the airport, refill the car. Well, wait a minute. With an EV, how do I refill the car? If I plug it in, it could take 20 minutes, 30 minutes, 50 minutes. Oh my gosh, I'll be late for my flight. And so a lot of people, even though they themselves own an EV, when it came to renting a car, not knowing what the charging stations were like in that community, not knowing where they could do something on the way to the airport, said, even though I like EVs, I'm going to rent a gasoline-powered car. So these cars were not popular among renters. And I think this is a great example of when we introduce a new technology, not knowing how consumers are going to respond to it in all of its different ways. EVs themselves are very popular. Sales of EVs in the United States went up, get this, 40%, 40% last year. So the public is buying them and buying them faster than any other segment. But in renting them, people are a little scared.
How did other car companies deal with this, or have they ventured into the EV fleet?
Well, while Hertz wants to put you in the driver's seat, it competes against nice people like Avis rental cars and Dollar rental cars and Thrifty rental cars. And the other car companies, when Hertz announced they were buying all these EVs, said, good for you. You go first. Tell us how it goes. And we're okay with playing catch up. So while most of the rental car companies in the United States do offer some number of EVs, they didn't really bet the farm strategically the way Hertz did. And in this case, if you bet the farm and you get it wrong, it comes back to haunt you. One other quick note, Scott, if I can, this CEO that's being terminated, this wasn't his idea. He actually inherited this. A previous CEO is the one who did all of this. He's the one who's trying to mop it up. And so I do wonder if there's something else behind his termination. In a way, it's wrong to hold him accountable either for the mistake that Hertz made or the fact that Tesla changed the prices. But nonetheless, he's the guy who's got to fall on his sword.
So I guess Hertz was hoping the marketability of the new EV idea would take off and there'd be a high demand as opposed to the practicality at the other side. Because many may say, well, you know, it's a good way to test drive one.
Right. Well, that's one side of it. Or also, I lead an environmentally friendly lifestyle. So when I rent a car in, I don't know, in San Francisco or something like that, I want an EV because it's going to be good for the environment. And many people think that way. But then they went, but wait a minute, where do I charge it? How do I get it back to the full? How do you prepay for a tank of electrons? So the practicality of it is the wrinkle. I think they'll come about. I still think there's going to be EVs in the rental market one day. But by being this pioneer and going first, Hertz has paid a price.
Marvin Ryder, professor at a group school of business, McMaster University. Marvin, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
I will.
Scott Thompson isn't satisfied with an answer.
He'll delve into the issue until he is.
You're listening to Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson.
On Hamilton's News, today's talk.
900 CHML.
Good news in the sense that it didn't go up. Inflation ticked down a little bit, about a tenth of a point, sitting at 2.8%, down from 2.9% last month. The usual things up, some things down, and we're sitting where we're sitting. What does this mean moving forward? Colin Mang is with us, assistant professor of economics, McMaster University, and here now. Colin, thank you for the time. I hope you're well.
Yeah, thanks, Scott.
Colin, this kind of reminds me of like, are you there, Colin?
Yeah, I'm right here.
This sort of reminds me of trying to lose the last few pounds on a long diet that you've been on. It seems that the ending is the hardest part. What are your thoughts on this ticking down a tenth of a point?
Well, I mean, this is great news for families that prices are really starting to stabilize. But when you look at what the data is showing us, there's really only one thing now that's really continuing to push inflation up, and that's housing costs. Increases in rent, increases in mortgage costs for families with a mortgage. That's really the only thing left that's pushing up prices. So in terms of losing that last pound, getting to that 2% finish line, there's only one more thing that we need to address. Everything else is now basically back to normal.
That is, unfortunately, a long-term fix, as we've heard. It takes a while to replenish housing stock. Because it is just, it seems highly or largely around housing, does that change things? Can we do things differently as a result of that? Or is it what it is? It's still inflation.
Well, I think it's going to put more pressure on the Bank of Canada to cut interest rates in April rather than June, as some people are predicting that we're going to have to wait till June for the first increase. Because again, with increased mortgage costs, as more and more families continue to renew their mortgages, they're seeing their payments jump, and that's what's contributing to inflation. So right now, it's the higher interest rates, which to some extent are actually continuing to push inflation up as families are renewing their mortgage. So I think this puts more pressure on the bank to cut interest rates sooner rather than later.
Now, if they do cut interest rates sooner rather than later, Colin, are you concerned that we could end up back where we were, that housing, because again, we're still going to have a relatively low supply of housing, although they're increasing that, we still have the supply that we have. Are you worried that with the lower rates, we could end up back where we were?
I don't think they'll go too low with the rates. I think we'll be looking at a quarter point cut in the spring and then maybe another quarter point cut in the fall. So we're not going to see massive interest rate cuts this year, not enough to, you know, cause families to go out there and splurge on all sorts of new things and push prices back up for other types of goods. But I think it would be a good thing if we see at least a little tiny bit of a rate cut coming in the spring and a little bit more later this year.
Is this more symbolic? It's down rather than up, which at least gives people feeling a bit more optimistic. It seemed for a while we were sitting on the edge of a recession that never really happened, but everybody thought we were in one either way.
Yeah, I mean, the economy really did slow down a lot in the third and fourth quarter last year. And we were kind of wondering up until the end of last month, you know, are we really in a recession? Then we found out that no, we just squeaked out a little bit of growth towards the end of last year to make sure that we avoided it. But yeah, there has been this sort of general malaise around, you know, rising prices, the fact that, you know, for a good year and a half, prices were rising much faster than incomes. People felt like they were falling behind. But that period is now behind us. We're seeing average wages grow at about 5%, which is much faster now than price inflation. So families are starting to catch back up. I think it still will be a little while, maybe another year or two, until families really feel like they're on a much more solid footing and that they've caught back up to where they were before the massive inflation started. But things have turned a corner. Like, it's very obvious that the economy is starting to improve and rates will start to come down this year. So I think there's a lot of reason to be optimistic.
So, but you don't think that the rate cuts will be dramatic enough to actually cause us to rebound and go back in? You're confident we figured it out this time?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, when you look across all of the other types of goods, so gasoline has been pretty stagnant for the past 5 months now, 6 months. We've seen declining or stable gasoline prices. When you look at other types of goods like clothing's actually cheaper right now than it was this time last year. Other types of things like furniture and electronics are cheaper now than they were this time last year. And part of that is because supply chains have rebounded. Like, we finally worked our way through some of those COVID disruptions. It took a while to get everything back up and running. But, you know, those problems are now behind us. So I don't see inflation surging back up to the levels that we saw a couple years ago. Really, right now, I mean, the only thing that have this constraint on is our housing supply. If we can build more of that. But as you mentioned, that is sort of a longer term issue. It is going to take a while to solve that problem. But that's really the only thing that we have as a supply constraint right now. And that's why it's the only thing that continues to rise really rapidly in price.
You were talking about stable gas prices for the last little while. We're hearing today that they could go up as much as 20 cents a liter between now and the 24th of May weekend. Do you think that will affect numbers next month or the month after?
Yeah, so that is going to be something to watch out for. We have had a very good run. I mean, from our peak, the last gasoline price peak was in August of last year, and then we had this long, slow decline. But that's also a little bit typical. When we think about the way that gasoline fluctuates over the course of the year.
Yeah, seasonal, yeah.
In the summertime, we definitely see much, much higher prices. So people want to go out in the summer. They want to drive around.
Colin Mang with us, Assistant Professor, Economics, McMaster University. Inflation down a slight bit at 2.8%. Anything that's down is good. Colin, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Yeah, you're welcome. Have a good day, Scott.
900 CHML, it's Hamilton Today. We're coming right back.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
We've talked about the leak at Canada's infectious disease lab in Winnipeg. Saw two Chinese scientists fired, let go, moved out of there. Nobody knows where they really are at this point. And now we're here, applicants for Canada's federal research grants So applicants from Canada, for Canada's research grants that are given out federally aren't screened for affiliation with China organizations like the Thousand Talents Program. This program has been implicated in leaks to China from that lab, which CSIS has warned pose a threat of economic espionage to research institutions. To expand on the story, Phil Gursky here, president of Borealis Threat and Risk Consulting, former CSIS analyst, and here now. Phil, thanks for the time. I hope you're well.
My pleasure, sir. Happy early spring to you.
Yeah, whatever that is. Thank you, Phil. What is the Thousand Talents Program?
Well, essentially, this is like any other Chinese program, Scott. And you and I have talked about this issue of how China's been robbing us blind, stealing our secrets, etc. When they send people abroad, it's with a specific purpose. And that specific purpose is to advance the People's Republic of China, its programs, its technology, its economy, etc., etc. This shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone, is that China does things in this way. Now, you could argue, Canada kind of does it too. If we send students abroad to learn things, they could bring it back and help us. But we're talking about an autocracy here, Scott. This is not a democracy. And they will instruct people to go to countries like Canada, acquire technology and information and knowledge that will further China's programs. And China's programs are not in Canada's best interest, to put it simply.
So why not screen these people? And is this the same reason where the other two scientists screen? Is that how this that issue started?
Oh, God, if I had to answer your question, Scott, I don't think you could afford me on your program. You're not paying me anything, by the way. This is just one more example of a government that's been provided with intelligence from my former employer's thesis about how China operates and to what extent. And it seems like it's going in one ear and out the other. Or maybe it's not even reaching the first ear. I have no idea. Maybe the people have earplugs in. But this is just another example how intelligence is being ignored. And as a consequence, Canada is suffering in the long run.
Did we learn anything from what happened with this initial investigation of the Winnipeg lab? Have they changed any procedure or process to tighten this up?
I hope so, although I did notice that the Health Minister, Mark Holland, did announce quite publicly that in the aftermath of the latest scandal, that Chinese scientists are still being welcomed at Level 4 lab in Winnipeg, albeit, as he said, not to work on the most, dangerous cases. But you would think that, if a bunch of people came and robbed your storefront, Scott, you might want to lock the door for a while until you had better security measures in place. And yet the government seems to think, well, we'll give them access, but not as much access. And so, I don't know. I'd like to think that behind the scenes that things are being done. But given this government's seeming ignorance or naivete when it comes to intelligence, I can't make that guarantee to you and to your listeners, unfortunately.
We remember that a lot of the situation in and around the two scientists happened when the Canadian government was trying to do a deal with China on the vaccine, and there was also an election at that point. With all of this going on and the lack of transparency, do you feel confident about the next election and interference that any of this has been stopped in any way?
I wish I did. Now, unfortunately, when it comes to intelligence and what CSIS knows and what it shares with the government, this crosses governments. I mean, this happened during the Harper administration, too, although I don't think to the same extent. I think this comes down to what you and I have talked about a lot, Scott, and it's basically is the immature intelligence culture here in Canada. And by that, I mean, not that CSIS and CSE and the RCMP aren't doing their jobs, but that the people on the receiving end aren't taking it seriously and aren't making decisions based at least in part on what intelligence is saying. And as we've discussed before, intelligence isn't the end all and be all. There's lots of things that go into decision-making, but it seems to me that we have a structure in government, and that's a large kind of overview that doesn't seem to welcome the intelligence when it goes against other interests. So I don't know, Scott. I don't know what it's going to take for this to change. Would it take a change in government? If there's unicorns and rainbows, maybe the answer is yes. But I'm afraid you and I will be having this conversation for another 10 years or so.
And when this first broke about election interference, we talked about this, and the Prime Minister, it was all new to him, yet Katie Telford testifies that nothing gets by him, it all goes to his desk. CSIS says we sent it to his desk, but clearly, and there, way back when this was happening, there's supposed to be some sort of process change, so this wouldn't happen again. It doesn't sound like that necessarily has changed in any way.
Maybe he needs a bigger desk. we're going to put more papers on it.
That's what it is. Push two of those desks together.
It's either that or there's people that are, look, the prime minister is a busy man. We get that. Yep. He has to, look at a lot of files. Maybe people aren't sending him the right things in the right order with the right priority. Maybe, I'm sure that, prime minister isn't looking at his email, his inbox in mail all the time. But there's clearly people under him that aren't prioritizing this thing in the right way. So has that process changed? They say it has. But again, I'm pretty sure you and I are going to have conversations to indicate in the future that the process, in fact, has not changed.
All right, Phil, let's change gears here. Many big cities, all size cities, have seen protests in regard to the Hamas-Israeli war. Some have gotten out of hand, crossed the line, too close to religious or healthcare institutions. The Von Mayor, Stephen Del Duca, pointed out yesterday that they're going to look into bylaws to see if they can curb or calm some of this down. Perhaps 100 meters from this or that, you can't be demonstrating. Your thoughts on making this announcement? Is this needed? Are the laws already there? Is this the problem?
It's a great question. Canadians have a right to protest. Canadians have a legitimate concern over what's happening in Gaza. There have been far too many civilian deaths, albeit, as I've said many times, Israel wouldn't be there had Hamas not killed 1,200 people back in October of last year. The problem, Scott, is that the protesters, maybe their hearts are in the right place, but demonstrating and blocking access to a synagogue is not what you should be doing. If you're critical of Israel, then you can demonstrate outside the Israeli embassy in Ottawa or against Israeli consulates in major cities. They're conflating synagogues with what Israel's doing, and that strikes me as that you're going after the wrong target. If you can't go into a Zara store at the Eaton Center in Toronto because people won't let you in because of Gaza, there's something wrong with our system. So yes, there are bylaws in place. If the Von Mayor thinks he has to maybe change the bylaws or add additions, that suggests to me that they're not strong enough or not being implemented. So we go back to the whole Freedom Convoy, Scott, where the laws were there, but maybe they weren't enacted properly or put into effect properly. Hard to say, but I don't think that religious institutions should be part of the problem here. If you got an issue with Israel, talk to Israel. Don't talk to a synagogue.
Obviously, it's apples and oranges, but if we would have seen at the convoy what we're seeing at some of these protests, I think it would be a different discussion right now.
I think so. Obviously, the convoy, it basically froze Ottawa for the better part of 3 weeks. A lot of disruption, a lot of very, very angry people. We haven't had it to the same extent, and that we don't have a 3-week protest like in Hamilton, for example. But there have been some disruptions. And, again, as long as you're following the law and you disperse when you're asked to disperse, that's okay. But if it gets beyond that, then I think action has to be taken because you have a right to protest. But I have a right to go to my synagogue, mosque, church, et cetera, and you can't take that right away from me.
Phil Gursky, president of Borealis Threat and Risk Consulting, former CSIS analyst, keeping us all secure. Phil, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
You too, sir. Take care.
Dan McTagg is warning us that the GTHA could see gas prices go up by about 80 cents a liter between now and the May long weekend. Obviously, the transition back to summer gas. And what else is there? Let's bring in Dan to answer the questions. Dan McTagg, president of Canadians for Affordable Energy, former Liberal MP here now. Dan, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I am, and thanks for having me. And I hope it isn't 80 cents. I think I might have heart failure. 20 to 25 cents looks like what we're looking at.
It's interesting because we're talking about inflation, and I just talked to an economist about that. It's down from 2.9 to 2.8%, and one of the reasons it is because fuel had been stable for such a period of time. This will affect inflation over the course of the summer, won't it?
Well, it will, and you know what? I was responding to several economists who had come out with stories in Reuters and Canadian press saying this morning would see higher inflation because of higher gas prices. I've checked my notes, which I've done for 30 years, and there's no way. Gasoline was pretty much on par with where it was this time last year. Diesel as well. So I left me scratching my head, but thank goodness I tweeted last night that this isn't correct. And it turns out those economists are nowhere to be found this morning. So I'm glad yours got it right. I think, though, looking forward, Scott, the bigger issue will be month-to-month comparison. So March 24 to March 23, you're going to see a pretty big increase. Same for April, May, and June. So inflation is not going anywhere except up. And the sooner our politicians and the Bank of Canada recognize the importance of energy, the sooner we'll get to trying to find a way to slow it down.
Reasons for it and the transition to summer gas?
Yeah, transition to summer gas, 7 cents a liter. That'll happen second week of April. Carbon tax up to 20 cents a liter by 3.72 cents a liter. And of course, we have oil moving up since last week, as I mentioned, $10 a barrel. So it's still it's gone up about 5 in 1 week, going to go up another 5 to 7. That's good enough for another 8 or 9 cents a liter. Then, of course, we have demand. Everyone's underestimated demand. Usually the woke crowd have done this, but those who've been pushing renewables and saying that we can buy all electric vehicles got it spectacularly wrong. Demand is strong in the United States. It's strong around the world, and supply just isn't meeting it.
All right. We're hearing more today that Germany and Canada are into some hydrogen deal, or the promise to look at it. Kind of sounds like PharmaCare. We heard about this a year or two ago. What is this? Is this smoke and mirrors, or are we actually, is the rubber hitting the road here?
Window dressing. Germany produces a lot of hydrogen. Other countries do as well. The fact that this is one step lower, it was the PM who basically told the German chancellor to go pound sand. There's no business case for natural gas or oil. So they came back now with a lesser announcement, promise of all sorts of wonderful things. But, you know, the problem with hydrogen is extraordinarily expensive to make. And yes, it produces energy, but it's very volatile. So for every unit of energy you get from hydrogen, it takes 2 units of natural gas or something else to produce it at substantial cost. So I think this is more, wishful thinking and stuff of magic and make-believe. There is a role for hydrogen. It's not now. It's not any time in the short term. We do use it in some processes, but not to replace or displace energy. Anybody who believes otherwise is dealing in fantasy land.
How are those countries producing hydrogen and dealing with that, two in, one out, the cost of energy? What kind of energy are they using to produce hydrogen, which isn't a fuel that has to be created into a fuel, which consumes more energy than it actually delivers clean, from what I understand. So how are they doing it over there?
Well, in Germany's case, it's some of it's being done with coal. The rest, where you can get it, natural gas. Very little of it's being done by windmills and solar panels. I mean, the process is known as electrolysis and how you produce that energy. But if it costs you, 2 units to produce 1 unit, obviously the cost benefit has been analysis and equation has been thrown out in order to be trendy and cool. The reality is that it's used for certain specific reasons. Fractionation and hydrocarbons, those kind of things are very important in that process. And yes, they produce energy. But it's an extraordinarily inefficient way in order to produce a form of energy when you have to, like everything else, use hydrocarbons in massive amounts to get what little you can get from hydrogen. Unfortunately, I mean, it shows a lot of promise, but there's a reason why it hasn't been given wider adaptation at this point, and why hydrogen is still a long way off, not to mention, and I really emphasize this in larger scale, its volatility. It's not something you want to fool around with, and it will come about, but it's not going to come about anytime soon. And it certainly is going to come about because we're trying to, rush to some political, way of getting back what you lost last year when the prime minister foolishly told Germany and Japan that there's no business case for natural gas or oil, which, of course, other countries like Qatar, Australia, the United States are only too happy in reveling in our stupidity.
What's coming next for hydrogen? What needs to happen? Why is it not? Why are we not there yet? Is it just the amount of energy it takes to produce it?
Yes, and there's a debate as to whether or not it's acceptable to use natural gas, which is a hydrocarbon, to produce that energy. And that's not to say you can't produce it with windmills, but windmills take a lot of energy to build. Windmills in the middle of Newfoundland are extraordinarily expensive to subsidize and to make, and they have effects on the ecosystem. They are not exactly efficient when it comes to distribution of energy. It's how you develop that electrolysis, the kind of energy you use to create the hydrogen and the cost up front. So if someone's going to tell you, hey, to do all these wonderful things, it's going to cost $5 to $15 billion and we'll recover that amount in 110 years, well, you know full well that those EWTs, those windmills will not last that long. You'd be replacing them several times before you get to recover that sunk cost. I think it's nice and it's wishful thinking, but for now we're still a long way off. And don't take my word for it. Ballard power cells, the power cell used, for instance, in buses. We've been subsidizing that thing since I was an MP back in the mid 90s, and it shows promise. But we're still a long way off. And so, great stuff on the fringe, great stuff to substitute to complement the energy mixes that we have, but it's not ready for prime time substitution.
Dan McTagg, president of Canadians for Affordable Energy, former Liberal NP on where we are with energy. Dan, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me, Scott. Cheers.
When there's an issue, Scott is all in on getting to the heart of it.
This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson.
On Hamilton's News, Today's Talk.
900 CHML.
The mayor of Vaughan, Stephen Del Duca, has yesterday spoke out and said he's looking for the city to approve a bylaw that would prohibit protests outside places of worship, schools, childcare facilities, hospitals, etc., that incite hatred, intolerance, and violence. To talk more about all of this, Duff Conacher is with us, co-founder of Democracy Watch, and here now. Duff, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Yes, thank you. Hope you are as well.
So far, so good. Duff, what are your thoughts, Vaughan Mayor Stephen Del Duca bringing this up? Is this needed? Do the laws already exist? What are your thoughts?
The laws already exist, and there have been questions about how police have been enforcing those laws, and those are legitimate concerns for people to raise when they're feeling intimidated or feeling that they have been threatened or harassed. The police have been, it seems like, trying to just tone everything down. But I think people have, in some situations, I've seen some videos where it just raises questions about why the police were not arresting people, because they were threatening people with violence or harassing them. And both of those things are crimes, and you can be charged. So there have been more arrests recently, but I don't think we need to go as far as what the mayor is proposing to do with and have city council in Vaughan impose these new rules.
Do you think that sends a message to police that, you know, we want this tended to? If not, we're going to use other means.
Yes. And I'm sure that the mayor is reacting to people in the community who are not pleased with some of the lack of enforcement in some situations from their viewpoint. Where they think that harassment or threats of violence have occurred. But to turn this over to municipal bylaw officers with huge fines, you're just going to be ending up in court with charter cases. I guess if the municipality wants to have its bylaw officers enforcing these kind of rules, but I think they're not really going to be discouraging anything. They're just going to end up spending a lot of money on court cases as people challenge and say their charter rights were violated, their right to freedom of association and freedom of expression.
Police say, Duff, that it's their job to keep the peace, to keep things calm, not to have things flare up. Where is the line, though? Who solves this issue? Who decides or who is deciding, if they are, when that line's been crossed and to act?
Well, police decide that. They are the ones who have an enforcement policy for every law. And every law is just words on paper. And the enforcement decisions are extremely important as to whether people actually have rights and protections. And people very legitimately and justifiably question the police in terms of their enforcement actions. The House Ethics Committee today held another hearing on the issue of the RCMP's investigation into the Trudeau cabinet and SNC-Lavalin trying to stop that prosecution. And there are ongoing questions about the police's policy, the RCMP's policy, and how they enforced the criminal code rules in that situation also. So we always have to be watching what police are doing, because they're the front line and they really decide whether there's a charge, whether someone is even intimidated into stopping doing something because of a police presence. And they have to be watched and held accountable, and they should be having very consistent enforcement across the board all the time on these situations. But these protests are happening in different municipalities, and you'll see different enforcement policies in different municipalities as the police take different approaches to dealing with protests. And so that's why you don't see consistency across the country, and you see a lot of questions being raised, I think justifiably in some cases.
So how do you create that consistency? Because again, for a lot of people, this is black and white. Either you break the law or you don't. And it seems we're now talking about a gray area where, you know, I'm not sure we should, it's a slippery slope. I'm not sure we should be going there.
You never create that consistency. It's an ongoing cycle of charges, people challenging charges in court judges, and again, across the country with different attitudes towards how these things should be enforced and where the line should be. Some cases going up to the Supreme Court clarifying where the line is, or sometimes creating more confusion, and then back down it goes to the front line. It's ongoing. It will never change. There is no way to have consistency of municipal police enforcement across the country because each force has a different chief. We will decide what is the priority in terms of resources and policies and how to approach these kind of things, especially when it's in an area like freedom of expression and an amorphous area as well, is whether you may feel harassed, but were you actually harassed? You may feel threatened, but was someone actually threatening you? And that's just the world we're in, and will never change because these are lines that are based on people's perceptions of situations somewhat, and that includes the police's perception of what's going on. So they have to be watched, they have to be held accountable, and if people think their rights have been violated, then they have to file complaints and pursue accountability and pursue court cases. But that's the only way to get your rights defended in either side of a situation, or and the protections that you're owed under the law as well.
Duff Conacher with us, co-founder of Democracy Watch, talking about Hamas-Israel protests that we've been seeing across the country. Duff, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
You too. Take care.
Car theft has been a big topic, a big issue, to the point where there's been summits about it, all sorts of discussions about what to do, but it seems to be getting worse. What are we up to? 40? Over the course of a day, I think they were saying in Toronto, and to the point where one police officer said, I just leave your key fob at the front door. It ain't worth getting beaten for if they kick your door down to steal your car. What do we do? How do we protect ourselves? Sean Sparling with us, retired deputy chief of Sault Ste. Marie Police, currently the president of Investigative Solutions Network, and here now. Sean, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
All's good. How are you?
So far, so good. I've always been meaning to ask, Sean, the charge for, say, somebody stealing your car out of your driveway, is that different than if they break into your garage to steal the car, or they break into your house to steal the keys for the car? How does that amplify the charge?
Well, certainly if they break into the house or break into the garage, you're into a break and enter charge, whether it be a residence or a place. If they just steal a car off the street corner, it's just theft of the vehicle.
So obviously a heavier charge, and thieves are taking a bigger chance if they actually break into a structure or a home or a garage in order to get this done.
Yeah, sure they are. It's actually break and enter, and it has a higher penalty, but certainly these people doing this kind of thieving really don't care about the extra charges.
Obviously, Sean, you were in law enforcement for quite a while, a retired deputy police chief. What are your thoughts about where we were and where we are now?
Well, it's very concerning. I listened to the Toronto police chief's briefing on this, and obviously they're taking it very serious. But this really comes down to just a change of policy, mostly at the governmental level and funding and whatnot, and taking our kind of our foot off the gangs and whatnot, and just allowing them to run rampant for the last number of years. And this is what the end result is.
We heard a suggestion, one officer saying, you know, I just leave the key fob at the front door. I wouldn't be getting into a fight over it or what have you if it's to the point where they're kicking the door down to get the keys. What are your thoughts of the comment or even the advice? Because at the end of the day, it certainly isn't worth getting a beating over.
Well, you're right. It's not worth getting into a violent confrontation with somebody over your vehicle. But the officer's comments, I think those were unfortunate. I'd be surprised that there's a high number of home invasions to get keys to steal cars to the point where he had to say that. He probably just said it out of context. And I saw even the chief of police was walking those comments back. I don't think they're actually all that appropriate under the circumstances.
So has the discussion moved from protecting your car to protecting yourself?
Well, not, Yes and no. Like, you always want to protect your own property and whatnot, but your property is not worth your personal safety and well-being. So that's always been the advice. If somebody's there and they're armed and they're going to inflict violence to steal your property, normally the best idea is just to let them take it. It's not worth getting injured over.
All right, let's talk about, because there's obviously carjackings, there's a situation where people would invade the home to get the keys, and then there's just typical car theft. Let's start with the first one, typical car theft. Is there any way, what is just some of the common sense things we should be doing? Is it worth investigating in an alarm system for your car or a tracking system? What are your thoughts on all of this?
Yeah, certainly those are the crime prevention measures. There's all kinds of them out there, like you just mentioned a couple of them, to try and slow the thieves down. Those are always good investments. And it's just like adding lighting to your home or security cameras. The best measures are preventative measures to make sure it doesn't happen in the first place.
What about, people say the obvious thing is just to put the car in the garage. Is that a deterrent at all? Or if they want it, they'll get it. They'll go in and get it.
Well, I think it is a deterrent. Like, there's always going to be those ones out there that really want that particular vehicle, and they might go to those lengths, but out of sight to some degrees out of mind, certainly locked in a garage to me is much more secure than just leaving it on the side of the road. So I would recommend that for sure.
All right, carjacking, we've seen an increase in that. Again, I'm not sure if it's something that everybody needs to be concerned about. It maybe doesn't happen as much as we think, or maybe it does. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that? What do you do? I mean, it would scare the bejeebers out of you.
Yeah, that's a violent event. Again, probably related a lot to gangs and whatnot. It's certainly something you want to be aware of, be vigilant, and really give them the vehicle. Is the best thing, and get out of it and take the kids and the family with you and just get out of the vehicle. That's a violent event and has to be respected like that as well.
Okay, let's move to home invasions. Is this similar to any type of robbery or home invasion? Is there anything different we can do if they're coming looking for a car? And is it often if they're looking for a car, they're not looking for anything else?
Well, it could be. It depends on the circumstances. If they're coming after the car, they're coming after the car, and they're going to force their way into the home. Typically, they're armed. And again, the best defense there is, in a sense, is that to give them the vehicle, give them the keys, and also take preventative measures for it not to happen in the first place. Like you mentioned, lock the vehicle in a garage, cameras, and whatnot, and take those crime prevention means. Maybe make it your target. You're not so such a target for this kind of event.
Is this something you can turn around in a short period of time, Sean? I mean, you know, we've got lots of issues, whether it's housing or healthcare, which can take forever. Is this something you can turn around in a relatively short period of time?
I think it's going to take some while to have like a lasting impact on it, but they are going to have an impact on it in the short term for sure. You're going to see arrests. You're probably going to see the numbers go down in the next few months. I would think they'll target the right people and get them in custody for this. But it's really a whole system that needs to change, the bail system, everything. But the police can do their part, and they'll get some good arrests, and they'll actually put a dent into this, I think, in fairly short order. But it'll take a little bit to have a lasting effect.
Do you think that organized crime is getting the message? Are they aware that, wow, you know, this country is being nailed a lot and it's starting to gain attention? Are they backing away, or is it, you know, it's a grocery list? They go in and get them because they know it's easy.
Well, they're certainly not backing down yet. But what they'll do is they'll target the street level criminals as well as the organized crime to try and put a dent into it. I don't see organized crime backing out of this soon because it's so lucrative. And to be quite honest, the laws in Canada and our incarceration rates are very lax on these type of things. So there's not a lot of risk in it for them at the moment.
The people stealing your car are far different from the ones that are organizing this. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I would suspect that you have organized crime involved in here, and it's going to push down to the street level gangs or street level criminals to actually steal the vehicles, and then they're moving the vehicles at the organized crime level.
So would they get, say, pay per car, paid per car, and then the organized crime would send however many over and then get paid for that? How does the commerce work?
Yeah, I think you're hitting right on the head. It's they're probably paying per job at the street level, and then they have it organized to go over to almost like brokers to take them overseas and then to resell them.
All right, Sean Sparling with us, retired Deputy Chief of Sault Ste. Marie Police, currently the President of Investigative Solutions Network, talking about home invasions and car theft and what we can do to keep ourselves safe. Sean, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
You too. Thank you.
Scott Radley's with us, host of the Scott Radley Show, coming up after the 6 o'clock news. You can read him in your Hamilton Spectator. He is with us now. Scott, I hope you're doing well.
Could not be better, even though it's snowing out. But other than that, could not be better.
Last day of winter. Spring arrives at 11 o'clock tonight.
Then, right? Appropriate.
Yeah, like we had to squeeze it in. You know, we didn't have much of a winter, so we got to squeeze it in the last days.
Yeah, and I don't know if I said this to you yesterday when we were talking about this, but I don't run the Around the Bay race because I am just out of shape and have no motivation to do such things. If I have to get somewhere, I take a car. But nonetheless.
Take a scooter around the bay? That would be fun.
It always seems to me, though, that it is either freezing cold or something like this. Like we just had how many weeks in a row of glorious conditions? Any one of those days, the people running around the bay would have said, I'll take it. I'll take it. Mm-hmm. And then we get close to this and in comes the snow and the cold. It kind of seems like it's a giant cosmic joke. But anyway, good luck to all the runners.
And a new longer route for those who really enjoy it, which is even better.
Yes, with some good news today, by the way. I was talking to Anna Lewis, who is the race director, and the Burlington lift bridge that has been under construction, that is still under construction, but she has been apparently told it will be able to be used for the Around the Bay race, which is, you know, saving everyone a giant headache if all of a sudden, because that would have been a new way around it and a new route and everything else. So it's all good.
Why not just leave the dang bridge up and you just got to jump in and swim across? Like, evil, what's the
Knievel
problem?
Yeah, evil Knievel.
It's like a...
Everyone gets a bicycle at the one end for those 100 yards. You pick up speed and try and
clear. An e-bike.
And if not, it becomes a triathlon.
That's what I'm thinking. A triathlon. What do we need? What else can we add to it? Why not swim across it? It can't be that hard, can it? You go first.
Yeah, exactly. Suddenly I'm having these images of swimming away from Alcatraz in that water. It's about the same.
Really. All right. We were going to talk about the Royals today, but we got stuck on Sophie Trudeau's book.
Oh.
Did you know that's coming? Yeah.
Wow.
So we never went from one powerful story to another.
Well, she's Canadian royalty, isn't she?
I don't know. I mean, do you think a lot of people are interested in what she has to say?
I don't know. Like, Scott, I still can't figure out why it is that people watch The View. So I'm clearly not the person who's best equipped to speak to who I would expect is going to be the target audience for this. I mean, I don't know. Is this sexist? I don't think so. I don't see a long lineup of men lining up to get this book. I just don't. And maybe that is sexist. I don't know, but it doesn't seem like that's the audience. But I also don't know if the target audience is women, who's really interested in hearing her thoughts on philosophy or walking in fields or whatever it is. The things that I've seen referred to that she is apparently writing about in this, these are not deep thoughts on world affairs.
No.
It's Sophie's thoughts on things. And like if she had not married Justin Trudeau, would there be a book here? I'm not saying she's not a person in her own right. She's not talented, all those things. But if she is not, if the last name Trudeau is not attached to this, is there a book here? And I don't think so.
And one other guest pointed out that during her time, during, you know, his term when she was married to him, it's not like she really had a cause that she went after. She was just kind of, there. It wasn't that she was one of those, spouses that decides to jump on board and grab a cause and take advantage of it.
And I'm not and I don't think a lot of people would have lined up to buy a book by Mila Mulroney either. Or from Jean Chrétien's wife or Paul Martin's wife. It's not because they are a wife and they are the woman in it. It's because we don't in this country have first ladies the way that they do in the States. It is a different role. It's a different position. And we generally don't put them on the same kind of a pedestal or platform that they do in the States or maybe in some other places. So it changes, I think, their level of fame. And again, I don't know what she's going to say that people are just going to be like, unless it's gossipy. I mean, if she decides to like go out in a bang here and just tear the roof off of whatever happened under the house into the cottage there with Justin Trudeau, and it's really salacious, then everybody, I think, will say, oh, I'll read that. But I don't expect that. Do you?
No. Interesting. And Jimmy Kimmel had both them on, Barack Obama and Michelle Obama. And I think Michelle Obama's book sold like 15 million copies. Barack sold like 5. So there's an example of
she's a superstar.
Her book was way more popular than his was. And he was the president.
Well, and I think, I mean, many of the former first ladies, I believe that George Bush is I can't remember her first name now. Not Barbara. Laura Bush. Yeah. I think she wrote one. And I think most of the first ladies, or at least many of them, have written them, and they've done very, very well for the most part. But again, it's a different – they are so much more not only in the public light, but you mentioned something else that's really different. They all – every first lady will latch on to a cause or causes and become the face of that and have a huge platform to do that. We don't – our wives of prime ministers, or potentially could be husband, they don't do that as much. So it's a very different scenario. But I don't know. I don't know. I'm sure we'll see some reviews, and I'm sure we'll see some things that she's had to say. And who knows? Maybe she'll come up with something just absolutely fantastic. And as I say, maybe if we're all lucky, there will be some peaks behind the curtain. But I'm just not sure that's going to be the case.
Scott Radley coming up after the 6 o'clock news. Read him in your Hamilton Spectator. Thank you, Scott. Have a great show.
Maybe she'll be able to tell us where Kate Middleton is.
He manages to squeeze the Royals in the last second.
Nailed it.
Safe. Very good.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Scott. Have a good one.
Thanks for listening to the Hamilton Today podcast. You can listen to the show live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 900 CHML and online at 900CHML.com.
That's it for us. Thanks for listening. As always, we leave it to you, the taxpaying customer, to have the last word. This one via email from Frank. I like it. According to unofficial sources, a new simplified income tax form contains only 4 lines. Number 1, what was your income for the year? Number 2, what were your expenses? Number 3, how much do you have left? Number 4, send it in. Keep right, except to pass.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.